Hello and welcome back to The Target, powered by Hollywood Bets. Today, we're going to dissect the biggest talking points from a captivating season of Premier League action. As always, I'm joined in studio by English Premier League analyst Jesse Nagel.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Tesh. Of course, it's international break. You know, this is, you know, they call the transfer season silly season, but for me, silly season is the international break because we get to discuss all weird things. I mean, yeah. I'm in a football group. I was having a food conversation not too long ago. So that's just the beauty of the international break and what it brings.
Well, this does provide us with a time to pause and take stock of what's happening. Let's dive straight into the title race. The heat is truly on at the top. After a brief stutter, Manchester City are unequivocally back to their best, and they have Arsenal firmly in their sights.
Yeah, it's amazing how reactionary of a sport that football is, because, I mean, you asked me the question, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, about Arsenal and their title credentials, and I said, yeah, you can almost start engraving the A, the R, and the S on the Premier League title and maybe get a good, you know, early bird special on some red and white ribbons being it this early. But, yeah, look, that's me just saying that because I had seen Arsenal in that current spell, and now Manchester City win a couple of games, they beat the champions 3-0, and all of a sudden you start questioning your own beliefs in Arsenal winning the Premier League. So yeah, Manchester City, you know, they've been the course and distance, they've got the know-how, they've got the experience, they've got every mineral possible, yeah, or every tool possible to go on and win it from here.
You must think that for Arsenal, the coming second, I think on three separate occasions, the last three seasons, to be fair, they need some clarity and focus now more than ever.
Yeah, there's two ways of looking at it. There's looking at it from the inside out, which is, you know, we've got the experience, we've been second, you know, we've three-peated second, in fact. So, you know, that's kind of experience. You know, there's the argument to be made that people learn more in defeat than in victory. So you kind of feel like Arsenal have all the experience and the know-how based on that. And then you look around and you've got Liverpool who've just, you know, their weaknesses are well identified. It's in the public for everyone to see. Manchester City, they've also lost a couple of games this season. You kind of feel like if Erling Haaland doesn't hit the back of the net, then, you know, there's opportunity there as well. And you just look at the rest of the league and then you kind of make a case for Arsenal. So that's looking at it from the inside out. But then looking at it from the outside in, those same points, you know, you look at them differently. I mean, you look at Arsenal as a team who three-peats at second, so they don't have know-how. They've actually have a weakness of they've led the Premier League and then bottled it at the end. They've been chasers and haven't been able to catch the leader. They've just had a season where they finished second and just fell off completely through inconsistencies throughout. So you kind of look at it from the outside in and you think, you know what, this team isn't like that special. So there's a case to be made for both, and it all just depends on which side of the fence you're sitting on.
Yeah, we're looking at the from the outside in. The injury list is staggering. I mean, we've barely played more than 10 games, 10 league games, that being said. And players like Victor Gyokeres, Noni Madueke, even your captain, Martin Odegaard, has been sidelined.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to that, there's Kai Havertz, there's Gabriel Jesus, there's Gabriel Martinelli. And these are all attacking players.
Yeah.
And, you know, Arsenal kind of built, you know, this huge profile of theirs aren't, you know, solidifying the defense. But, I mean, defense stops you from losing games. But, you know, there's nothing up front to kind of win some games. And I think we saw that last weekend against Sunderland where they failed to, you know, to really put Sunderland to the sword, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yes, they scored two goals. Yes, it was kind of a positive second half. But, you know, someone like Victor Gyokeres, someone like Gabriel Martinelli, at least
you felt they could have gotten on the score sheet, yeah?
Oh, definitely. I just feel like, you know, when Arsenal were in that rhythm in the second half, you know, the likes of Man City, the likes of Liverpool of yesteryear, they go on to score 3 or 4 goals. Yeah. And you could see that Arsenal needed that extra goal, because a third goal would have kind of sealed the game for me.
Yeah. Well, in staying with strikers, that imperious, relentless form that Erling Haaland has defined the Premier League season by is resurfacing. And it's a warning shot to everyone. I mean, you look at his performance against Liverpool. Mm. Despite having a penalty saved, he did go on to find the back of the net.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, he doesn't even give us an opportunity to really dwell on that penalty miss, because he scores, 10 minutes later, a Didier Drogba-esque header.
Precisely.
I mean, it's honestly, Desh, it's ridiculous, because he's, I want to say he's perfect. He's no weaknesses in his game. You'd think that he can't build up play. Look at him this season. He's passed the eye test on that. So from a numbers perspective, he's succeeding on all fronts. The eye test, he's passing that as well, because he's, you know, he's visually appealing now, whereas you thought of him just as a goal scorer. I think now he's just the complete forward, and for me, the best striker in the world is comparisons with Harry Kane. Haaland's number one.
Wow. Shout out to Tottenham striker, Harry Kane, former Tottenham striker there. you know, in a season where margins are razor thin, you must feel that a mental stumble can be turned into a full-blown crisis. But it looks like Pep has managed that, because they had a very shaky start to the season. But I think they're going by their last 3-4 league outings. It looks like they've turned the tide.
Yeah, I mean, we've said this before. In fact, already this season, where, you know, they win a couple of games, and then I think it was a defeat to Brighton, where, you know, it just kind of derailed them again. So, I mean, we've seen this from Manchester City before. So I think let's not get carried away. But then also in saying that, Manchester City have shown us in the past, 5 of the last 6 yeah. league titles, all being sky blue ribbons. So, yeah, you'd be a fool to kind of disregard them. But am I a fool? Maybe. Maybe.
In keeping with Premier League titles, I actually think Man City and Liverpool are responsible for something like 8 of the last 9 on offer. Could be mistaken there. But what is happening at Liverpool? Arneslot stick or twist?
Well, I mean, he's kind of earned himself the credit to go and, you know, have another chance to kind of get them back to where they were last season. But I think,
so defend his title, is that what you're, yeah, sounds, I mean, like what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, if you're referring to stick or twist as in, you know, sack him or keep him, I think you have to keep him. It's just that, 5 defeats in 11 games. So that would be, based on this, it would be 10 defeats in 22 games, which he can't keep that up. Then he's gone.
More recently, it's 4 from the last 5 league outings. 4 yes. losses so from your last 5.
18-10 then.
Man United if have keeps, climbed them.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I was looking at a stat, and Manchester United have lost less games in 2025 than Liverpool. And, I mean, you speak to any Liverpool supporter, you speak to any Man United supporter, you tell them that stat, and they can't believe it. In fact, that's been tried and tested. I've just, on my way here, I was, like, looking for some Liverpool fans, and I was like, hey, do you know you've lost more games in 2025? And they couldn't believe it. So, yeah. It makes you want to question that stats, and the fact that it is actually true, and our listeners out there are more than welcome to go and Google it. So, yeah, back to your question, Arneslot, you have to keep him just based on last season.
Yeah.
But football is a cruel sport. It's also a reactionary sport, like we've touched on.
Yeah.
So if this continues, yeah, it's over.
Did you see a sliver of hope when Liverpool went to the Etihad to play Man City? I mean, I know the scoreline was 3-0. They did have chances, though.
I disagree, Desh. I've seen Liverpool fans say this, and, you know, yes, the chances might have been the offside goal that you're referring to.
There was also the one where Salah was clean on goal, and I think he tried to flick it past Donnarumma. That could have been 3-2. There's also the free header. I know shortly after the second half resumed, they had a header.
Gakpo, was that the Gakpo chance you're referring to?
At the back post, there wasn't a header, but he skied it. I think it was Kirkes who played the ball across there. It was from the right-hand side, and Kirkes was on the left. But Gakpo had a tap-in at the back post, and, you know, we just spoke about what a tap-in is meant to be. He skied it.
Yeah, look, I think by definition, and I mean, football is a game that has, you know, been overtaken now by data and analytics. And what the numbers say is that Liverpool had their first shots on target in the 75th minute. But then I think it was 3-0 already. So for any Liverpool fan to say that, you know, the game should have been different, or, you know, you'd go back to the offside goal and whether it was offside or not, and, you know, there is a case for either argument. I just think that self-reflection is so key over here, where you have to look at yourself and be like, look, you know what, this is a team who, yeah, we've champions, but they've got way more experience than us, and, you know, they kind of made Liverpool look like a novice in the game compared to the level that they reached. So I don't think there's many positive signs off the back of that fixture against Manchester City for Liverpool. And, you know, we're talking about title races. By definition, what is a title race? What does it mean to compete?
Yeah,
it means you got to be within touching distance.
Yeah,
I don't think they're within touching distance. They would need about 3 or 4 games now to overturn a deficit. Are the top two going to, you know, lose the next 3 or 4 games? Probably not.
Yeah, it's going to be a massive question as to whether or not he can recover from this. Mm-hmm. I want you to move the conversation over to Mo Salah, because if you're looking at the talisman of Liverpool, it's undisputed, it's him.
Yeah.
You also look at the back with Virgil van Dijk being there, but he's also looked exposed, been exposed. Mm. You saw the game against Man United. Mm-hmm. I think it was van Dijk who was at the but midpoint of the pitch, and then he didn't track back, and then Brian Mbeumo gets the drop on him. Yeah. Then you look at Salah as well, not putting away those chances against Man City. I know you and I are possibly on different ends as to whether or not Liverpool had had a chance against Man City. I think they had a few chances.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at Salah because he is the one that should have buried those chances. I think if he also had Nick O'Reilly, he couldn't get past Nick O'Reilly, and no disrespect to Nick O'Reilly, but there's been dozens of wingbacks that have years of experience, and probably Salah got past those with just a drop of the shoulder. Now you can't get past a 20-year-old Nick O'Reilly.
Yeah, I think it's good for you to single out the, you know, the leaders in the team, or the supposed leaders in the team, but I think it has to come down to coaching as well. And if Nico O'Reilly's having the better of Mo Salah for 80 plus minutes, the coach needs to do something where you put a Conor Bradley further up the pitch and move Salah more centrally, where you know that maybe a Guardiola or a Ruben Dias doesn't have, you know, the same kind of strength that Nico O'Reilly has. And yes, of course, there's years of experience between the two, but perhaps there's a weakness that, because his more data to study on Ruben Dias and Josko Vardial, perhaps there's more weaknesses that can be identified. And now, you know, the thing is with Nico O'Reilly, and we see this a lot with players making their debut, how they shine so early. It's because, you know, the analyst team don't really have enough background to really spot some weaknesses. And I think that was the case of that, just really. So, for me, it comes down to coaching. Salah shouldn't have been, you know, stretching the pitch and playing out wide and playing into Nico O'Reilly's hands. But I think just on the Salah Van Dijk conversation, the previous week, you know, they kind of silenced us against, Real Madrid and Aston Villa. Both players, you know, had amazing performances.
Mm.
But then, you know, for players of that seniority or that level,
I need them to come through every week.
Every single week. Yeah. I mean, you can kind of have this conversation about a Konate, a Cody Gakpo.
He was the one who let Haaland score that goal. I don't even think he challenged him in the air. And, you know, it was a perfect ball from Matias Nunes. I think it was practically unmarked at the back post, and the hang time on the delivery, everything was exquisite.
It's incredible. But, you know, the conversations we're having about Van Dijk and Salah, these are the conversations we should be having about Konate, Conor Bradley, Milos Kerkez, Cody Gakpo. Not the most senior players in the team, or not the players
the next generation of leaders
who you look to as, you know, we're in trouble.
McAllister,
those
are number 10, number 8 jerseys of Liverpool, respectively. Those are senior figures in a team.
100%. So, you know, Van Dijk and Salah are almost undroppable in the Liverpool team, regardless of how many bad games they put in a row.
Or regardless of their ages.
I mean, we can look at that as well. But, so, you kind of need
them to
perform.
A decision to make. That's why I bring this up, because earlier this season, the FSG,
those big contracts.
Yeah, FSG went ahead and abandoned their wage structure, and I felt that at the time it was a perfect decision, an excellent decision. And I think the, you know, you mentioned data. There was a Liverpool scout who was on a podcast, and he said that after comparing players like Salah to their peers, as in your Ronaldos and your Karim Benzema's, they did go on to perform very late on their career. And to be fair, I think the two of them are still playing right now in Saudi Arabia. So the evidence backed that if you award Salah with a contract, you can still get him for about 3 to 4 seasons.
Yeah, I think they also like... I think pulled the wool over everyone's eyes by not spending in the transfer markets. I think they only signed Federico Chiesa for like 12 million. So they had...
They promoted Rio, I think, to the first team as well.
Yeah, which I mean, that didn't really cost... that didn't dent their pockets too much. So I think by them not strengthening in the transfer markets, they just, you know, spent that money internally and gave players improved contracts. I don't think it was the best move, because now that a Salah is underperforming, he kind of knows that he can't be dropped, because who's going to come in his place? Chiesa? I mean, we've kind of seen that Chiesa is not the answer. He's not the truth to Liverpool's answers. I mean, Virgil van Dijk, who's going to come in for him? Joe Gomez? Like, do you know what I mean? So it's...
There's no two I see.
Nah, there isn't. And Liverpool owners have kind of shot themselves in the foot by not spending that money more wisely, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of ownership groups, should we be keeping an eye on Old Trafford?
Yeah.
Currently 7th on the Premier League table. After 10 games being played, it's a respectable return for Ruben Amorim, considering the United team that he inherited.
Yeah, it's so tricky because, you know, you kind of have to look at last season as a starting point for Ruben Amorim. But I think for him, his tenure began this season. I think he almost completely wrote off last season. And, you know, those 15-plus games that he took over Manchester United or whatever the number of games he's been in charge for, I think he kind of drew a line through that. And I think he told his players to kind of prepare for this season. So the fact that, you know, they've done more learning last season and now it's all about implementing, I think we're kind of seeing the fruits of his labor unfold.
Yeah.
Manchester United, I mean, the system, we can't even complain about the system, the 3-4-3 with the double pivot in midfield with Bruno and Casemiro. Even that's working. So, I mean, we spoke about Haaland at the top of the podcast, so how he's silencing his critics or not even giving us a chance to really critique him.
Yeah.
Ruben Amorim's almost doing the same thing.
What's the secret to this United attack? I mean, I know you just pulled out the formation, but they've scored 2 or more goals in each of their last 5 league outings.
I think, see, when you play a back three, you almost invite pressure. Because you kind of have to. That's just what your shape suggests, especially with the two-man midfield. So you're going to get outnumbered in the middle of the park, which means that you've got 2 other places to outnumber your opposition. Sorry, you can either outnumber them in your defense or outnumber in your attack. So you kind of surrender the midfield. And I think Manchester United have opted to outnumber in
that wide zones
and wide attack. You got
Mazraoui,
Diallo, Mbeumo, Cunha, Mount off the bench. Those are key areas for Manchester United and so key to how they set up. And I think the thing that's highlighted the most is Ruben Amorim's 3-4-3 and the double pivot. But we're not seeing how the wingbacks, who are part of almost like a front five at times, we're not seeing how effective that is. And I think that's the key to Manchester United's upturn in form.
Yeah. Just before you wrap up the podcast, your thoughts on players like Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho, Rasmus Højlund? I believe they're all still contracted to Man United in permanent deals, but they've been loaned out.
Yeah, I think it's just their wage structure, which probably that's why they can't get off. Also, I mean, a signing is a commitment. Rasmus Højlund was signed, what, just 18 months ago or a season ago? I think last season was his first season or second season. But, you know what, I'll draw parallels to Nicolas Pepe at Arsenal. He was signed
Your
for
most expensive transfer,
72 million pounds.
Cronky splashed the cash that window.
And I don't even know how much he was sold for. So it goes to show that, you know, signing a player is a commitment. Florian Wirtz was signed for 116 million. Liverpool can't sell him now because they're not going to get 116 million back. So it's the exact same. And you can almost say that it's not going to work out. I mean, yes, it's early. We're going in early and we're making a big call now. But same with Alexander Isak. Hasn't worked out. That's what, 125 million or 120, whatever the fee is.
Well,
I just know it's money I can't afford.
10, 11 games in, so they are not the likes. Because, you know, I spoke about Hoyland, who's in his third year of possibly a five-year deal.
Mm.
Rashford, well, it's like his 20th something year at the club. Second outside of the club roller.
Yeah.
And then you look at Jadon Sancho, of course, he's been... The year that, I think it was Ten Hag loaned him out to Borussia Dortmund, not only does he end up in a Champions League final, but I think he had two man-of-the-match performances in the UEFA Champions League that season against the likes of Barcelona.
Yeah, but that's what he is. He's a moments player. I mean, even his loan spell at Chelsea. I remember seeing his debut, and I messaged my brother, who's a Chelsea supporter, and I was like, wow, you've managed to get Jadon Sancho back on track. And he was over the moon.
Yeah.
And then it took me 2 weeks later to be like, sorry, I was wrong. Can I, you know, delete that message I sent you? Because I look like such a fool, because Jadon Sancho kind of resets to factory settings.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just the inconsistent person that he is.
Yeah.
So those players give you moments. I mean, even Marcus Rashford, who's been superb in the Champions League, great in La Liga as well for Barcelona. I still see him as a moments player.
Yeah. Against your big six opponents,
he could come in, score a goal in the final and score the winner and, you know, steal all the headlines, but then all season he'll just give you like a 5 out of 10.
It sounds like you're saying those players should move on, Man United should move on, and it's a done deal.
Yeah, the relationship's broken already. I think the fact that Marcus Rashford, just looking at him in isolation from the three, in fact Rasmus Hojlund as well, they've gone into kind of shine at those new clubs, both Napoli and Barcelona. They're not going to reproduce that same form in a Manchester United jersey. I think emotions have just gotten the better of them, that that relationship is just sour. It's too toxic to even go back to. But Jadon Sancho, they just kind of need to just let that one go, I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jesse, that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Hit the Target, powered by Hollywood Bets. It's been a pleasure unpacking the biggest talking points from this Premier League season. Until we meet again next weekend. Cheers.
Cheers.